This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, my name is Francis, and welcome to the New Books Network. Today, I have with me Bart Ehrman, a distinguished professor of religious studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and the author, among other books, of Armageddon, What the Bible Really Says About the End. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
The book focuses on the book of Revelation. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about what actually goes on in the book of Revelation.
Well, the thing is, most people don't read the book because it's too weird and bizarre and they can't make heads or tails of it. But it's if you have somebody explain it to you who actually has a sense of how it works, it's not that difficult. The book is basically about a set of visions that a prophet named John records. He is taken up into the heavenly realm in order to see what's going to happen at the end of the world, which he thinks is coming very soon. He sees God on a throne who is holding a scroll in his hand, and the scroll is sealed with seven seals. and so there, and then he sees this Lamb of God who's been slain. This is representative of Christ, who takes the scroll and starts breaking the seals. The scroll ends up being revealing what's going to happen in the course of history, and they start happening. And so he breaks these seven seals, and there's catastrophe after catastrophe after catastrophe on the earth. When he breaks the seventh seal, it leads to seven angels who have trumpets. They each blow a trumpet. Disaster after disaster after disaster hits the earth. Blows the seventh trumpet, and then you're introduced to seven angels carrying bowls of God's wrath that they pour out one at a time on the earth. Disaster after disaster after disaster. And then finally, there's a final. So basically, God is exhibiting his wrath against the world because it is a sinful place, and the only people who are going to be saved are the followers of Jesus. And at the end, there's a big battle, the Battle of Armageddon, where all of the armies of the earth are destroyed, and then God brings in a new kingdom on earth for his slaves, the followers of Jesus, and they inherit then this amazing city of gold with gates of pearl, and all the others are wiped out, and then the followers of Jesus rule the world for all time. That's the book of Revelation.
Intense.
Yeah, it's intense. Yeah.
Who wrote the book? Who was John of Patmos?
Yeah, well, all we know about John of Patmos is basically what's in the book. The book had difficulty making it into the New Testament because there were people who said it was written by Jesus' disciple, John, the son of Zebedee, who's also was also thought to have written the Gospel of John. And people who thought that thought, well, it should be in the Bible because it's written by one of Jesus' disciples. There are others who said, actually, it can't be written by the same author as the Gospel of John. The writing style is completely different, and it has a different point of view, and so they didn't want it in the Bible, and so we don't know who this John is. John was a common name among Jews in the first century. He's on the island of Patmos, which is a small island off of the west coast of Turkey, and he says that he's there because he's suffering a tribulation or persecution problem or something because of the testimony of Jesus. And so we're not quite sure what his situation is, but he's living on this small island of Patmos and he's writing this thing. The only things we can know about him, we have to infer from the writing. One thing we can infer is that has to do with the writing itself. He's not a very good writer. he actually makes grammatical mistakes. It's the worst Greek of the New Testament. It's written in Greek, like the other books of the New Testament. Scholars have sometimes thought that it's because his original language would have been Aramaic, the language of Israel at the time, and that Greek is a second language, which is why he doesn't write it very well. I used to think that. Now I just think, yeah, no, he just can't write very well. I mean, most people can't. And back then, hardly anybody could write at all. And so he's much more highly educated than 98% of the world, but he's not a cultural elite. He's not a sort of high-level author.
So even despite the poor grammar, do you think people in John of Patmos's day were like, what is going on? Or was it a literary, or was it a genre that they would have understood better back then?
Yeah, I think the problem is that today when people pick it up, they read it in one of two ways today. And it's precisely because they don't understand what the genre is. One way that people read it is they, especially people who are committed evangelical, Bible-believing Christians, they tend to read it in order to find clues about what's going to happen in our own future. And so they're picking this verse and that verse, and they're not reading it as an entire text from beginning to end to try to understand it in its own genre and historical context. Other people pick it up who are not Bible-believing Christians. They just kind of interested in seeing what it says, and they can't make heads or tails of it. so those are the two main options. Historians have long recognized that it is, in fact, a genre. It's within a genre of writing, and the genre scholars have called apocalypse. And we have other apocalypses from the time in both Jewish and Christian circles. And so what historical scholars do is they read these other apocalypses and try to understand how the genre works. And it's like anything else. If you don't know how the genre works, you're not going to understand it. And so with my students, I compare it to like if you take just a modern science fiction novel and you send it back to the 18th century and have somebody, you know, in the 1740s read it, they have no idea what in the world is this. It's like they couldn't make heads or tails of it. And it's because they don't know the genre. We read a science fiction novel. We know exactly how it works. And, you know, it's not surprising. It's just we can evaluate whether it's any good or not. But, we have no problem with the genre. The apocalypse genre is like that. If you're not used to it, then if you get just one example of it and you just have one example in the New Testament, then it just seems just completely out of this world. But I think almost certainly people at the time who were accustomed to this kind of genre would have been able to understand pretty much how it works and would have understood a lot of the weird symbolism in it as well.
How can you spot an apocalyptic story? What's characteristic of the genre?
Yeah, so that's the key question. And for this genre are always books by holy people, somebody, a special person before God, historically, usually. Usually they're pseudonymous. The author claims to be a famous person from the Jewish past, usually, or Christian past. The person is given visions where they either see heaven itself, which is revealing the secrets that make sense of the earth down below. And so the heavenly realm explains why what's happening down here is happening. Or they have a series of symbolic visions of what's going to transpire in the future. And so it's either a heavenly journey or a historical kind of sketch, prophetic historical sketch. And some books combine the two. The book of Revelation actually combines those two aspects. The visions are bizarre, with weird animals and horrifying scenes and catastrophes and all connected with what heaven's doing to make things miserable down here on earth. The symbolism is normally explained to the author, who also can't make heads or tails of it, but usually there's some angel standing by who will explain what's happening and what it's about. And the trick for understanding these apocalypses is to pay attention to the interpretation that it's given. The interpretation itself is never self-explaining, but it usually gives you all the hints you need if you're paying careful attention and you know enough about the historical context. And so what happens in these things is typically it's showing that even though the world is a mess down here, in fact, it's going to get worse and worse, ultimately God is sovereign and he has a plan and it's all going according to plan. And at the end, it's all going to work out for those who are the true followers of God, whoever they are. And that might be, you know, a handful of people, or it might be some people. It's rarely the entire human race.
So since it's conception, have Christians always applied, have different generations of Christians always applied this specific book to their own generation?
Some have, yeah. From the beginning, because John, the author himself insists that these visions of what's going to happen on earth are going to come soon. He says it six times in the last chapter. And so it's emphatic. It's happening soon. And of course, none of these things did happen that are described in the book. And so there have always been Christians who have said, well, he means soon for us. And that's become the typical interpretation today among Bible-believing Christians, is that this is describing what's going to happen in the 21st century. They said that in the 20th century, and they said in the 19th century, in the 18th century, and all the way back. For most of history, that was not the normal way of reading the book of Revelation. For most of Christian history, since about the 4th century or so, readers believed that the things described in the book either had happened already or were happening in their own day, that they weren't predictions of the future, let alone predictions about the 21st century. This idea that it is predicting what's going to happen soon. You hear people in, you know, conservative Christians today saying that the signs are now at last being fulfilled. The prophecies are coming true. It's right around the corner. That interpretation that's widespread among groups of Christians today was not held throughout most of the Christian church, but it's become such a part of fundamentalist Christianity that even people who aren't Christian today assume that's what the book's about, that it's talking about our future. And it's absolutely not. And historians know that it's historians are pretty clear on this one, that the John of Patmos, who wrote this thing, was writing for his own audience. And he tells us who he's writing for. There's seven Christian churches in Asia Minor that he's addressing this to. And he knows these churches, these people in the churches, and he's writing for them. And it's pretty clear he means that this is a message for them, not for people living 2,000 years later.
What is the message he's trying to send to those churches?
Yeah, well, he's telling the churches they better shape up or they're going to be wiped out with everyone else. The book is really about how the world gets wiped out. I mean, it's a very gory, bloody book. And the book itself says that it's about the wrath of God against the world and against the people in it. And so a horrifying suffering takes place on earth. And the book actually, after the introductory chapter where John introduces himself and says that he has this vision of Christ, before he goes up into the heavenly realm in chapter 4, Christ dictates seven letters to him. This is in chapters 2 and 3. He dictates a letter to each of the 7 churches of Asia Minor, Turkey, that he's addressing. And so it's churches like, you know, Thyatira and Smyrna and Ephesus. These are cities and they've got churches in them. And he directs a church to each of these, a letter to each of these churches. And Christ tells them, that, you know, there's some things they're doing well, but there's some things they're not doing well at all, and they better shape up or they're going to lose their salvation and they're going to have it just as bad as the most rank pagan. like these others, they're going to be tossed living into a lake of burning sulfur at the end, and, you know, they'll be destroyed. So he's trying to explain what's going to happen at the end so that these followers of Jesus get back and become more faithful to what they're supposed to be doing.
So you're pretty emphatic that the book should be read in its specific historical context, that the predictions that John is making are very grounded in the time that he's living in.
Yeah.
In the Roman Empire.
Yeah. 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 I am pretty emphatic about that. And it's not just, you know, of course, it's not just my view. It's the common view among historical scholars, whether they're Christian or not. A lot of the good scholars, best scholarship on this is written by Christians who are just, you know, they're historians. They understand how this genre works, but they're not fundamentalists. And if you actually read the book carefully, it's quite clear who the enemy of God is, the figure that I think most people call the Antichrist, even though the term Antichrist does not appear in the book of Revelation. But there's an organized enemy of God, and the author makes it really clear that it is the city and empire of Rome, and that Roman emperor is the big enemy, and the empire is the enemy, and that God's going to wipe them out. One way to think about this is that when today you have fundamentalists who say, you know, the time is being fulfilled, just read the headlines, these prophecies are happening now, and it's going to happen very soon, they're not talking to people living 2,000 years from now, they're talking to the people in their own day. Well, John, on whom they're basing these ideas, was also talking to people in his own day. And they don't realize that, but it's quite clear historically that's what's going on. His enemy is Rome, and he thinks God's going to wipe it out.
So does reading the book of Revelation from this fundamentalist futurist perspective have an effect on the way that one conducts themselves today?
Yeah, it does. And it's I spent a good bit of time with that in my book, because the idea that Jesus is coming back soon to take his followers out of the world, the fundamentalist understanding of that is called the rapture. The rapture is Jesus comes back. He takes his followers out of the world before all these disasters hit. That idea is not found in the book of Revelation, period. It's not there. It's been imported into Revelation. And in fact, it's nowhere in the entire Bible. I try to show that in my book. We actually know when this idea started, this idea of a rapture. It started in 1833. We know who and where and when. We know everything about it, but people ignore that. But they say, oh, no, it's in the Bible, but they're just misreading these passages. But it seriously affects things in ways that you wouldn't expect. For one thing, it's caused a lot of psychological damage to people and emotional damage. Since I wrote this book, I've been getting emails from all sorts of people saying, oh my God, yeah, when I was a kid, I heard about this rapture and it just terrified me and it's really messed me up. I'm still messed up because of it. So you get that kind of thing. But in my book, I show that it's bigger than that. It isn't just people who were raised as fundamentalists. It actually has led to very serious damage, sometimes slaughter, people being killed. The whole thing with David Koresh, the Waco disaster 30 years ago, was rooted in David Koresh's understanding that the end was coming soon because of his interpretation of the book of Revelation. It was rooted in his misinterpretation of Revelation. But more than that, these interpretations of Revelation as coming true soon have affected American foreign policy. I mean, who would have thought that? But in fact, because evangelicals are so gung-ho on this idea, these ideas that they claim to find in Revelation. They think that for prophecy to be fulfilled, Israel has to have a complete control of the land, the promised land. You have to, you can't have Palestinian territories there. It's got to be controlled by Israel. And they, and these people believe that they, that that Israel has to take over the Temple Mount, where there are now Islamic holy sites in Jerusalem, and they have to take down the Temple of the Rock, the temple, the dome of the Dome of the Rock, which is where the ancient temple, Jewish temple was, because in this view, the temple has to be rebuilt. And you can't rebuild it when there's another building there. And so you have to take out one of Islam's most precious holy sites. Yeah, well, that could lead to the disasters. It could lead to World War III pretty quickly. And so anyway, so I explain like a number of things, including, by the way, a burning planet. People who believe that Jesus is coming back soon are not, they're shown. I mean, it's absolutely well documented that evangelicals, as a rule, do not have have a high priority for controlling climate change, because what's the point? The end's coming. And so, yeah, so, you know, there are all sorts of ways we might destroy ourselves. And people who believe that Jesus is coming back soon based on a misinterpretation of Revelation are, you know, might bring it about. So it would not be good.
So it's not just the personal or the individual psychological effect. There's also structural and societal effects that come from this reading of the book of Revelation.
Yeah. And it's, you know, and so that's why, so my book Armageddon is meant to not just show, you know, yeah, this is an idea that's just wrong. You know, it'd be better if you didn't think that. It's really serious for everyone, because this misunderstanding of the Bible has very serious social and political implications. And it affects huge things. It, you know, who would have thought it affected the move of the American embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. That was in support of evangelicals who want Israel to have a stronger hand and are very much behind American support of Israel. And in my book, I absolutely do not take a stand on the Israeli-Palestinian issue. You know, I'm not at all arguing one way or the other on that. But I am very interested in the history. Why do evangelicals so strongly support Israel at the same time that they hate Jews? They say they don't hate Jews, but they, you know, they think all Jews are going straight to hell, but they want to support Israel. It's because Israel for them is a fulfillment of prophecy, whatever Jews happen to think. And Israeli politicians have recognized that since the 1970s. When they realized, man, there's sure a lot more American evangelicals than there are American Jews. We should go for the American evangelicals. And they started doing it with Menachem Begin, and then, I mean, yeah, and so on down till today.
Ronald Reagan was also influenced by evangelicalism, correct?
Yeah, he was. He was taken with this, there was a fellow named Hal Lindsey who wrote a book in 1970 called The Late Great Planet Earth. Many people will not have heard of this book, but it was the best-selling book of nonfiction in the entire decade of the 1970s. I mean, of any book, not religious book. I mean, outside the Bible, there were more copies of this thing sold than any other book. And so it made a big splash. And he was predicting, Hal Lindsey, who's still going strong today, he's not going that strong, he's very old, but he still has a radio program. In 1970, he was predicting, based on his interpretation of the Bible, that Jesus was coming back before 1988. And that after Jesus came back, there was going to be a crisis in the Middle East, where Israel was going to take over the Temple Mount, and then an Arab state was going to, a coalition of Arab states was going to attack Israel, and then the European Commonwealth, a 10-nation European Commonwealth, was going to come in support of Israel, and then Russia would get involved, and then China would get involved, the bombs would go, and right before we blow ourselves off the planet, Jesus would come back and for the last time. And so Reagan was really taken with this, and so was his Secretary of Defense, Caspar Weinberger, and they thought Bible's teaching this. The nuclear bombs are going to fly. And boy, that's not a comforting thought for your commander-in-chief.
Terrifying.
So, I mean, he didn't, you know, it wasn't that he wanted it to happen like under his watch or anything, but he really did think, apparently he really thought it was going to happen.
Oy.
Yeah, boy. Right.
So the Book of Revelation is a book of vengeance and violence. It's not a book of love and mercy. Should we understand it as an account of one side of a multifarious God? Or should we understand it, or should we try to disengage it from our understanding of the true God?
Yeah, right. Well, it kind of depends on what your religious perspectives are, I think. What I would say is that most people misunderstand Revelation, not only those who are fundamentalists or who are influenced by fundamentalists to think that it's predicting what's going to happen soon. That's just understanding it incorrectly, I think. But the other side of the interpretation spectrum, historically, for the last 100 years or so, has been that it's not about the predictions of the future. It's about providing hope for people who are suffering. That's a common way of reading it, especially among more liberal Christians. And it's what I taught for years and years. Even when I wasn't a Christian, I would teach that the book is really trying to provide hope for those who are suffering now, because it's saying that in the end, God's going to make it all right, and that he's going to destroy the evil in the world and make it all good again. And so I thought, well, that's a hopeful message. But when I started really studying it again, I mean, I've studied the book for 50 years, but I mean, when I started really digging into it for this book, I came to think, you know, that's just not right. It's not right. It's not a book of hope. The word hope does not occur in the book of Revelation. Never. Doesn't show up. The phrase love of God never appears in the book of Revelation. God isn't said to love anybody in this book. He's said to be angry. The words are not hope and love and mercy and peace and justice. The main words are words like vengeance and revenge and wrath and blood and violence. And it's like, oh, that's what the book's about. In response to your question, you know, people often tell me that people who haven't really kind of dug into the Bible much, but they've just heard this, that the Old Testament has a God of wrath and the New Testament has a God of love. And, you know, they prefer the God of love. Well, that's great. I say, but when they tell me that, I say, you know, if you think the New Testament's God of love, have you read the book of Revelation lately? You talk about wrath. Far more wrathful than anything in the Old Testament. And moreover, the God of the Old Testament is also a God of love. And so, you know, love your neighbor as yourself. That's the Old Testament. And so you could say, as you're putting it, that maybe God's multifaceted. You know, he's both a loving God and he's a just God, and he shows mercy to people, and he shows wrath upon people. And maybe it's both things. And that's certainly one way to look at it. Another way to look at it is that different authors have different understandings of God, and that these are not, it's not the same God. At the end of Armageddon, at the end of my book, I contrast what is John's portrayal of God and Christ as wrathful and vengeful and hating their enemies, with the teachings of the man Jesus himself in the Gospels. That the Christ of Revelation does not seem like the Jesus of the Gospels at all. And I make a case that, in fact, they're very, very different. And that Jesus, who says to turn the other cheek and to love your enemy and to pray for those who persecute you, is not the Christ of Revelation who's out for blood. I think it's actually a very different portrayal, and that it isn't like two sides of a coin. It's really an either or, and that people who are interested in, whether they're Christian or not, but they're interested, say, in following the ethical teachings of Jesus, that you have to decide, you know, are you going to be kind of the out for blood, vengeful type who joins God in wiping out your enemies? Or are you going to be the kind of the loving, merciful type who tries to work for peace? They're different portrayals, I think.
So if we're not going to be reading the book of Revelation as prophecy, and it also doesn't really offer a positive or constructive understanding of God, can we does it offer any relevance to readers in our day, or what can we get out of the Book of Revelation at this point?
I think we can get a lot out of it, and it's an amazing book. I mean, I started out as a Christian, and I was a very conservative evangelical Christian, very committed Christian, and I loved the Bible. And now, for a variety of reasons, not really related to my scholarship, I'm not a Christian at all. I'm an atheist, but I still love the Bible. I think it's great. And the Book of Revelation, I think, is great, but oh my God, I do not see it as representative of reality or of ultimate truth at all. But it's a useful book because you can see a lot about religion in that book. In the modern world, in our American context, there are a lot of Christians who are much more fond of the view of God in Revelation than they are fond of the God portrayed by Jesus. And so if you happen to be somebody who is, just a complete white nationalist who's out to kind of wipe out everybody who's not, like you, Revelation's the book for you. that's good for you. But, the rest of us think, yeah, I don't know. That isn't kind of representation of truth that I want to support. I think it's valuable for that reason. I think the Bible is full of various views of God. The New Testament is filled with various views of Christ. And the recognizing that allows you to interpret each of these books for what it has to say, rather than assuming that it's saying the same thing as every other book. And it also then gives you a choice. How do you want to model your life, and how do you want to understand ultimate truth and ultimate reality? Because here are some options in front of you that people have held as sacred, and you can decide as well.
So, why do you think that it has proven so seductive to each generation to think of themselves as the final generation and to think that the apocalypse must be happening to us? Obviously, we're the end of the road.
Yeah. Look, I mean, it's all about me, baby. All of history's come down to me. And if not to me personally, at least to my generation. Aren't we the lucky ones? We're living at the end. And then you find out, yeah, it's actually talking about the Roman Empire and how it's going to be just, well, that's disappointing. Who's going to read that book? Why? Who cares? Another failed prophecy. But if it's about us, then it makes us important. It makes us significant. It makes the headline news less frightening because it's been predicted. Right. It makes it a fulfillment of divine providence. It means that you can rest assured that God really is sovereign. You've got massive starvation in the world. You've got earthquakes. You've got fires. You've got flooding. You've got international. You've got invasions of other countries. You got superpowers fighting it out, either actually or kind of behind the scenes. And it's all predicted. This is what was supposed to happen. And if we just hold on a while longer, God's going to make it right. And so it provides solace and hope and comfort for people, even if in the end, it's a wrong reading of Revelation, and it's one that can lead to a lot of damage.
That makes a lot of sense. Well, we are running out of time. I just wanted to ask you before we go, is there anything else that you're working on right now that we should look out for in the future?
This book on Armageddon made me think a lot more about certain aspects of the teachings of Jesus, the historical Jesus, the man himself. And it's hard to get back to the teachings of the man Jesus, because what we have are gospels that were written decades later by people who didn't know him, and they're putting their own spin on it based on their own beliefs. This is fairly standard historical understandings of the New Testament. But I'm interested in the man Jesus, and especially his ethics, because he too thought, like John of Patmos, he too thought that the end was coming soon and that people needed to prepare for it. And a lot of, I think, his entire ethical teachings, his moral teachings are rooted in the idea that you better shape up soon because, you know, you could be in trouble here. And I think it's very different from the view of John, the way Jesus does it, very, very different from John. But his ethics are rooted in that. His ethics are very radical. I don't know anybody. I literally don't know anybody who follows Jesus' teachings. And Christians are going to think I'm crazy for saying that, and they think I'm crazy anyway, but I really don't, because he was very radical. And so he was radical because he really thought the end was coming soon, and that's to affect how you behave. But his injunctions for how to behave are still applicable. He thought that what really mattered was not what you personally believe. It's not believing in him. It's not what we think of as like really conservative fundamentalist Christianity or anything like that. It's helping people who are in need and doing everything for those who are needy now, because that's what God is concerned about. So Jesus picked this up from the Old Testament, from his Jewish tradition, but he radicalized it, and it ended up making a huge difference in society. So my next book is about the radical ethics of Jesus, why nobody follows them, but why they also just made the most enormous difference in society. Christians invented hospitals. They invented orphanages. They, you know, Christians started thinking they had to, you know, they needed to take care of people in need. And that was a weirdly, that was an innovation. So that's what my next book is about.
Well, I can't wait to read it. It sounds very fascinating.
Thanks.
Thank you so much for being on the show.
My pleasure. I've enjoyed it.